Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf Conversation, boys and girls. The first one of the new year, 2019. I know it seems like it's been forever for me, and I hope it seems that way for you, which means that you've missed me. I originally interviewed Jane Levy 8 years ago, and it's been a long time in coming for her latest book, which is a tremendous success. It's called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. And I like to tell my friends it's not just about baseball, but it's about society, popular culture, celebrity culture. And if anyone can tell a story like that, it's Jane Levy. She wrote a couple of books about the greatest heroes of the boomer generation in Mickey Mantle and Sandy Koufax. And I asked her a long time ago, as I mentioned in the introduction to her conversation, what she was going to be working on next. And she said Babe Ruth, and well, rather than go into that, I'll just let you listen to the Bookshelf Conversation with Jane Levy. Jane Levy, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
My pleasure, Ron.
So when I was preparing for this, I went back on our previous conversation, and you've written about Mickey Mantle, you've written about Sandy Koufax, both heroes of the baseball boomer generation, and I asked you who your next subject was going to be, and I was surprised when you said Babe Ruth, because so much has already been written about Babe Ruth. Perhaps he and Jackie Robinson have had more words written about them than anybody else in sports history. So why did you decide to go for the Sultan of Swat?
Well, I laughingly like to say I needed to have my head examined. I was fully aware then that the first question I was going to be asked, no matter what I came up with, was why in God's name do we need another Babe Ruth book? And that actually was the first line in the Kirkus review of The Big Fellow. You know, why do we need another one? Well, if it's this one, we do, which is makes me feel that I accomplished what I set out to do, which is to find a new way to tell the story of Babe Ruth and a new story to tell about him. When I looked at the previous biographies, all of which are very, very good in many ways and contribute a lot to the understanding of him, what was missing from all of them was anything in depth about his family and his upbringing, which remained shrouded throughout his lifetime and, you know, another 70 years since, in confusion and mythology. And there's always a reason for that. Some of it was technological and how hard it was for previous biographers to get at now digitized information that turned out to be available to me, which I never expected. And part of it is because he had something to hide. And my reportorial, you know, instincts told me that if that's missing, there's a reason that it's missing. So it was as if in all those other biographies he emerged fully fledged from St. Mary's Industrial School on the western edge of Baltimore, a reform school to which he was consigned by his parents on June 13th, 1902, and emerges, you know, somehow like completely fully grown and in a Baltimore Orioles uniform in the spring of 1914, Orioles being a minor league team at that point. So I knew that there was some major void. And as I said, there's usually a reason for the void. And in that void, two colliding mythologies had grown up about him. One was that he was an orphan. There was no basis in fact for that. And people still say it to me today, oh, he's an orphan. And he would be at pains to say, no, I had parents. But he never went further. And the only reason people thought he was an orphan was because he never talked about his family and because St. Mary's did accept orphans. But it was primarily a school for wayward boys and who had no roots, no place else to go, for incorrigibles, which was a legal term used back then to designate boys who were sent by the courts for being in trouble with the law, and they did accept some orphans. So the other myth about Babe was that he was an incorrigible and that his parents had gotten a friendly justice of the peace to determine that he needed to be sent there, because that's what you had to do. He had to be sent by the courts if you were going to go as an incorrigible. So that was equally untrue. But nobody could have known that until I was able to stumble on the documents outlining the really Dickensian parameters of his childhood. His home was, he came from a broken home. A marriage of his parents to George Sr. and Kate was tumultuous, and it was marked by the death of at least four children, maybe six. I could only find documentation for the births and deaths of four of the children. So by the time Babe Ruth is seven, he has lost at least four siblings, and he's seen them die. And yet, when his parents send him away and they only have two kids left, they still don't want him. So how is that going to feel at age seven?
And you make that point. He was seven. I mean, how
bad could he have been?
How bad could he have been that they sent him away?
Yeah. And so that had to be extraordinarily confusing and painful and formative of his sense of himself. So off he goes to St. Mary's. There's some evidence that he was in and out of the institution for a period of time, but basically that's where he was raised, and certainly from 1906 on. And that's because that was the year that his parents were divorced. And those divorce documents were, I was able to find at the Maryland State Archives. All I had to do was click a mouse, and up popped every part of the case file, including the arrest of Kate Ruth and the bartender with whom she had been consorting, and the testimony and depositions in the hearing, which George Sr. Alleged that she was both serially unfaithful and constantly drunk. And on that basis, he was granted a divorce within 2 months and gained custody of the three children. And she was effectively marginalized and out of her children's life. And she'd be dead six years later at age 39. So when Babe Ruth said to his daughter, Julia, who is still alive at age 102, "I think my mother hated me," it's not that surprising. And what he also said to Julia, and the only thing he said to Julia about his time at St. Mary's, was, "I never felt full." And I think that is both a statement of actual physiological hunger, because the Zavarian brothers were operating on a budget that was always insufficient to feed the number of kids they had. And I think it was also a statement of emotional hunger and emptiness that he carried throughout his life and filled later with women and booze and a big, roistering life, and all the fans, all the boys that would pile out of rickety stadiums across America to cling to him.
Now, you mentioned the second part. That makes him seem very self-aware, and that's not the kind of image I think a lot of people have of Ruth, that he was very self-aware in other ways about his wants and desires. But talk about, if you will, for a little bit, his intellectual capacity, because I think that doesn't get enough credit.
Well, I wasn't inferring a degree of self-awareness. I don't think that's something I can assess from this point on. I think this is you know, my authorial take on him and the hints that he dropped throughout his life. And they were only hints because he did not talk about this at all. And given the thousands of interviews he gave, you know, surely there was ample opportunity to have shared this with reporters. And perhaps he did on the grounds that they never write it because, of course, it was a very different time, Ron.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you know, his agent would schedule a big expose on 60 Minutes or, you know, with Diane Sawyer, and you'd have a very sympathetic telling of this story that would enhance his image. Back then, that wasn't going to enhance his image. So when, you know, Harry Brundage at the St. Louis, I think it was the Star, said to him in 1929, "So you're an orphan, right?" He got really angry. "No, I had parents," but he never went further than that.
No, I'm glad you brought up the agent aspect because he was, I'm guessing, the first major national sports celebrity, and that in part was due to his agent, Christy Walsh. Talk about Christy Walsh a little bit.
Well, Babe and Christy had a completely mutually beneficial relationship. Christy Walsh was a failed ad man, PR man, sports cartoonist, sports writer, who in February 1921 came up with the great idea to try to get Babe Ruth to sign a contract to allow him to market ghostwritten articles under his name. Now, ghostwriting had been around for a long time, but it had never been really systematically done. And Walsh, who was pretty desperate, apparently, according to his nephew Richard, found out where Babe Ruth was staying at a hotel, climbed out the exterior fire escape to the Babe Ruth room, cracked open the window, found him in bed with a blonde, slapped him on the butt, and said, "I want to represent you," which is the kind of moxie that, and you know, you can imagine Babe Ruth would have appreciated. He also offered him, you know, 10 times as much as he'd been getting for the very, very limited dispatches he would send back to the syndicate that had been printing his stories. Get another today, and then, you know, the writer had to make something out of it. So it started that way. By the mid-20s, Walsh had him under a 3-year contract. You know, today we call it a personal services contract. He had created the Christy Walsh Management Company, and he was completely in charge of all of Babe Ruth's financial affairs, which protected him enormously because he was insolvent for much of the early 20s, and Walsh got him back on track by parading him around the country in vaudeville tours and in barnstorming tours, and by putting his mug on every endorsement that he could think of. And this was all new. And it wouldn't have happened with a different personality, and it couldn't have happened at any other time to the degree that they made it happen because the technology for amplifying fame was being completely, you know, reinvented as they were doing this. The radio, telex, telepix, you know, ways of sending words back to newspaper offices from afar, ways of sending pictures overnight, including one of Babe Ruth's mistresses in 1925, across the country. This was unprecedented. When Babe Ruth came into the major leagues in 1914, fame was local. It was small, and people learned about your feats after the fact. Now, suddenly, it was present tense, and Walsh exploited all of that to Babe Ruth's incredible, luck.
And then, yeah, timing is everything. Do you think, had Ruth come along at another time, it's a combination of the technology that was available plus Ruth equals success and national celebrity. these days, they talk about the 15 minutes of fame. Everybody's a viral celebrity for a little while. How big was Ruth to the nation? And not just while he was playing, but even afterwards.
Well, I'll give you an example. In 1921, June, you know, 5 months after this deal gets done with Walsh, Ruth gets arrested, I think for the third time, for speeding on Riverside Drive. He was an enthusiastic man behind the wheels. And the guy who arrested him actually was a motorcycle champion, but he was a cop and he didn't seem to recognize Babe Ruth. So he goes down to the courthouse in Mulberry Street with his counsel, and he is advised to plead guilty, and is shocked when he is sentenced to a day in jail. And, you know, he'd been told that, you know, if he paid his fine and said he was sorry, that nothing would happen. So he ends up in jail and for a day with a lot of other chauffeurs, as they were called, who were in the cell for the same reason. And there were reporters, like, all over the neighborhood trying to see and capture an image of Babe Ruth in a jail cell. And there's one guy on a fire escape with a reporter down below shouting to him, "Do you see anything? Do you see anything?" And the guy says, "I see a shadow." And the reporter says, "Snap the shadow." Because that, you know, that was enough of Babe Ruth to matter. And when he got out, because the day of jail was liberally defined, and, of course, the game at the Polo Grounds would have started at 3 o'clock, he went with a police escort to the Polo Grounds, traveling at a rate of speed which was considerably higher than the speed he was arrested for going on Riverside Drive.
So you've written about Mantle and you've written about Koufax. Both of those are contemporary, and you knew Mantle. You spent time with Mantle. I'm sorry, I forget how much time you actually were able to spend with Koufax, but this is a totally different type of project. I mean, other than his daughter, I don't imagine there are too many people you could have interviewed. So most, I'm guessing, of your research was done, as you say, digitally in libraries and other. What was that like? Compare the styles. And which do you prefer?
I'm a journalist who was trained to find people and get them to say things they didn't want to say. hard to do that with dead folks, mm-hmm. There were more than more people available than I would have expected. There were granddaughters who helped, and Julia Ruth Stevens, his 102-year-old daughter, helped. But I also was able to find some aging boys of summer, including the ineffable Roger Angel, who recalled either seeing him play or meeting him in a locker room. So I was able to get some eyewitness testimony. But the ferreting out of the pieces of history from newspaper archives and state archives was painstaking. It was like putting together a mosaic. And I would, over a period of 8 years, collected little shards of glass and, tile to carry the metaphor forward, hoping that at the end it would end up as a viable, big picture. And talking to people is a lot more fun
than sitting behind a desk or in a library, I'm sure. Part of the job of an author, especially a book such as this, is talking to the people, going on book tours, and I'm sure you enjoy that. But when you come to a personage such as Ruth, I'm sure you get a somewhat older audience, and I'm guessing that there's always one or two wise guys who will try to trip you up.
Sure.
How challenging is that?
I have a stock line, Ron, and guys always try to trip you up with, like, how many times did he drive in runs with two outs in the bottom of the ninth inning?
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking along statistical lines.
And I always say to people, sports writers, first of all, those kind of statistics wouldn't have been kept in Ruth's era. I mean, it's only a function, again, of the computer age that we can know the answers to so many things. But I always say, you know, sports writers are smart. They look things up.
Well, one of the biggest perks, I think, of this whole project is you got to throw out a ceremonial pitch at Yankee Stadium.
I did.
How did that come about?
It was courtesy of HarperCollins, my publisher, to whom I will be forever grateful for making my dream come true. I did this on September 21st, a day that will live in infamy. And my kids were able to come with me, and my daughter later said, "Mom, you threw a curve." I had practiced all year, which is to say since June when I found out that I was doing it. And the first thing I did was ask Sandy Koufax for advice, and he said, "How far can you throw it?" And I said, "Oh, 40 or 45 feet." And he said, "Stand 30. And he said, "Whatever you do, don't go to the mound." And so I worked all summer, and by the end of the summer, I really could throw 60 feet, 6 inches. But, you know, your heart gets in your chest, and you get a sense of just how enormous that distance really is. And so, when I thought about going to the mound, and then I thought, you know, who am I to defy Sandy Koufax? So I was probably just about 40 or 45 feet, and I threw a breaking ball. Now, it depends on which tape you look at. One tape, it looks like it bounced in the dirt right in front of the catcher, which I would call, you know, a great inside curveball for a left-handed hitter. In other versions, it looks like he caught it on, you know, without it bouncing. I'm not sure. I'm going with it didn't bounce.
There you go. One other thing I wanted to ask is, the fact that you are a female journalist, does that have any play in the reception you think you receive for your work?
I think if it did before, not any longer. I just think we're kind of past that. I think that was certainly true when I was a reporter at the Washington Post at the beginning of my career. My great friend Dave Kindred and I, sometimes would compare stories and, you know, see whether we could take the byline off and see if anybody would notice the difference between, a female written story and a male story. I think that it was actually, in some ways, an advantage to be a female sports writer. In that, you know, I always observed in locker rooms that male reporters seem to feel the need to compete with their interview subjects instead of saying, you know, what was that pitch and what happened when it landed, you know, in the far right field pavilion or some such. A male reporter would be just as likely to say, "So, what happened to that breaking ball?" And the guy would look at him and say, you know, "Doofus, it was a fastball," right down the middle. So I always thought that guys felt the need to show their bona fides. I didn't pretend to have any bona fides, so it was easier for me. In certain stories, gender makes absolutely no difference. You're writing a game story, everybody's going to write the same story. Or should. Do I think as a female that I might have asked different kinds of questions in a context of a feature story or of a book? Yeah, I think probably I did, you know. But I don't, you know, I think some guys still try to trip me up, but with, you know, statistical things, as I mentioned. But it doesn't happen very much anymore.
Now, you're about to embark on a book tour? Is that?
Oh, I'm deep into it. I'm going to Boston and New York this week, and then back to Baltimore at the Babe Ruth Museum on Saturday. And then I don't know. I really don't know what happens after that.
Still a very, very exciting time. We've been talking with Jane Levy, author of Babe Ruth and the World He Created. Let me amend that. The big fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created.
Those titles all run together.
Because he certainly did create a world of sports coverage that we now know and enjoy. Jane, thank you very much for talking with us today.
May I add one story, Ron?
You certainly may.
Well, I couldn't have, you asked about Koufax and Mantle before. I couldn't have envisioned this, and it certainly wasn't planned. But the three books actually do work together in a kind of interesting way that I wouldn't have envisioned. They're all, to some extent, about celebrity and the culture that has given us the Kardashian family, for example. Sandy Koufax is a guy who eschewed celebrity, who didn't want a book written about him, and therefore did not collaborate on my book with me and never gave me an on-the-record interview. I stated at the very beginning of that book what he was willing to do, and what he was willing to do was answer questions of fact. And so I was able to go to him and say, you know, is this true, is that true, which you can only do with somebody who's as honorable as Koufax. But he understood that being famous can eat your soul and your sense of yourself. And so he respectfully disengaged himself from that part of our society. Mantle's a guy who was, I think, destroyed by celebrity. The 19-year-old kid from Commerce, Oklahoma, who comes to New York in the midst of the 50s, the early 50s, a New York cafe society eats him alive. Everybody wants to buy the Mick a drink. And the drinks that they bought him and continued to buy him long after his playing days were over led to the disease that killed him. He was, of course, an alcoholic, and they didn't create it, but they didn't know that they were contributing to it. And, of course, the comparisons to the Babe didn't help. And Babe Ruth, as the subhead of this book indicates, created celebrity. He was the model for American celebrity, as Roger Angel said to me. He's the guy who created the template for how to be famous in the new world of popular culture.
Yeah, you always hear about celebrities sitting down talking to each other. I can easily picture Ruth and Mantle talking to each other, but I would love to see Ruth and Koufax in a conversation.
Since I can ask Sandy matters of fact still, I'll see if I can find out what he'd like to know from Babe Ruth.
Again, thank you, Jane. A pleasure as always, and best of luck. Oh, one last thing. What's next?
Oh, I haven't got a clue. What would you do? What would you do next?
Oh, my. I would go back to Koufax and see in his twilight years if he would reconsider doing a book and working with him. That's what I would love to do.
I think the answer would be absolutely no, mm-hmm. For exactly the reason I just explained. I don't think he can go backwards. You know, I don't know as an author whether I could do that and in any way feel that I could contribute something new, and there's no point in doing something unless there's something new you can do with it.
And on that note, we will say thanks again to Jane and wish you all the best, and hopefully we will see something from you in the future that we can talk about again.
Well, I'll tell you what, if any of you guys have an idea, do let me know.
Thanks, Jane. Be well.
Bye, Ron.
Bye-bye.
And that was our bookshelf conversation with Jane Levy. Hard to believe it's been so long since I've done one. And further, it's hard to believe that we're coming up on 100 of these baseball bookshelf conversations. I encourage you to go to Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com and look in the sidebar on the right-hand side to see who I've had the opportunity and pleasure of chatting with, including such people as Claire Smith and Marty Appel and Lincoln Mitchell and Michael Leahy, Eric Sherman, Russ Cohen. I feel badly to leave anybody out by just reading off a few of the names. So I do encourage you. It was a lot of fun to do, not just authors, but musicians and artists and movie makers. So, yeah, please go to Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com and take a look at the different people that I've had the chance to chat with. Again, if you have any suggestions on who you'd like to see or hear actually in the future, including that 100th guest spot, please drop me a line at ronkaplan'sbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. And come back often, and now that the season is starting up and there are a bunch of new books coming out, I hope to be doing this blogging thing a little more often. So visit at the site for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on our favorite sport. So long, everybody.
Pitching that fader so grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land."